Okay, today we're going to be looking at Acts chapter 23, continuing our discussion there, where Paul has the opportunity to speak before the council, specifically in reference to why he had been, to the accusations made against him. So one of the things we're going to do today is we're going to have a little bit of a history lesson, because to answer a couple of the primary questions that come up in this particular section, you have to understand a little bit of the history of what led up to the particular statement that Paul will make. And most of you probably have an idea of what that is, but we'll get to that here in just a bit. So hopefully I don't lose you in all the details, but I think that they're interesting and bring this a little bit more to life, if you will. So let's just, for the sake of some context here, we'll start here in Acts chapter 23, verse 1. We'll read down through verse 10, and then we'll pick it back up here in verse 2. Paul, looking intently at the council, said, "Brethren, I have lived my life with a perfectly good conscience before God up to this day." The high priest Ananias commanded those standing beside him to strike him on the mouth. Then Paul said to him, "God is going to strike you, you whitewashed wall. Do you sit to try me according to the law and in violation of the law, order me to be struck?" But the bystanders said, "Do you revile God's high priest?" And Paul said, "I was not aware, brethren, that there was a high priest, that he was a high priest. He was high priest. Blech. For it is written, 'You shall not speak evil of a ruler of your people.' But perceiving that one group were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, Paul began crying out in the council, 'Brethren, I am a Pharisee, a son of Pharisees. I am on trial for the hope and resurrection of the dead.' As he said this, there occurred a dissension between the Pharisees and Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. For the Sadducees say there is no resurrection, nor an angel, nor a spirit, but the Pharisees acknowledge them all. And there occurred a great uproar, and some of the scribes of the Pharisaic party stood up and began to argue heatedly, saying, 'We find nothing wrong with this man. Suppose a spirit or an angel has spoken to him.' And as a great dissension was developing, the commander was afraid Paul would be torn to pieces by them, and ordered the troops to go down and take him away from them by force and bring him into the barracks." Okay, despite my rather poor reading there, can't see very well this morning. That was quick. Yes, sir. No. No, that's what we're going to work on today. We basically just got through verse 1 last week. So verse 1 that we spent quite a bit of time on last week, and we talked about how Paul could say that he had a clear conscience before God. Knowing all of his backstory, knowing, you know, the fact that he had been sent out by the Jews to basically be the blunt instrument against the Christians and so on and so forth. We talked quite a bit about that, so I'm not going to rehash all of that this morning. But we want to look here in verse 2. Paul makes his statement in verse 1, verse 2, "The high priest Ananias commanded those standing beside him to strike him on the mouth." Smack. Okay. So, this Paul's statement of having a clean conscience before God angers Ananias. He doesn't like the fact that Paul is making this claim. And so this interaction between Paul and Ananias, there's a lot of different explanations for it. If you look at the commentators, I am continually amazed. I shouldn't be, but I'm continually amazed at some of the, in my mind, ridiculous explanations for what Paul says here with him. When he says, "I was not aware that there was a high, that he was high priest." Some people were like, "Well, he was blind and he couldn't tell." Other people were like, "Well, he didn't recognize who he was." I don't think any of that is true. I think it's a twofold answer, and we'll cover that. But there's a lot of different explanations for it. I think the most thorough and logical investigation, that, and I think that makes the most sense scripturally, can be found in Barnes' Notes on the Bible, in which he heavily references Josephus's The Antiquities of the Jews. So he uses The Antiquities of the Jews for a historical, political context. And this, I think, leads into, I think, the best explanation of how Paul could say that and have it be both 100% accurate and 100% accurate scripturally. Okay, So let's talk a little bit about this. We're going to walk through a synopsis of a whole bunch of stuff that I've read on this, from obviously Barnes Notes on the Bible, the Antiquities of the Jews, the Wars of the Jews, from Josephus as well, Encyclopedia.com, the Ancient Roman History Site and Discussion Forum at UNRV, and Classical Wisdom Weekly from ClassicalWisdom.com. So there's a whole bunch of source material that I've pulled together to put this together. So let's first of all talk about Ananias. So he served as high priest from 47 to 59 AD. Okay? So the events of this trial, if you look on your little cheat sheet, they're right around 58. Okay, so it's shortly before Ananias is no longer high priest, serving as high priest. Okay? A couple of things about Ananias is he was known for extreme greed and cruelty. He was accused of robbing tithes from the priesthood. So all the lower priests that would receive the tithes when they would make the regular offerings, you know, the people would come up and they would offer their animal sacrifices or their grain offerings and all the portions that the priests could keep. Ananias was accused, and his father as well, were accused of stealing the tithes from the lower level priesthood to the point that they were almost starving. Okay, so it gives you an idea of who this guy is. He was also known for rendering extreme punishments for relatively minor infractions, things that were outside the Mosaic law. He was also described as a violent, haughty, gluttonous, and rapacious man, and yet looked up to by the Jews. Okay, so a lot of not good things about this guy. I mean, it gives you a picture of who he was. So, Ananias was the son of Nebodinus, according to Josephus. Nebodinus was the high priest when Quadratus, who preceded Felix, was president of Syria. Okay, I know I'm already, some people's eyes are glazing over. Okay, let's stop for just a second. So, Syria, if you have a map, is north. Okay, and this is, again, from a Roman perspective. Syria is in the northern portion, okay, which is where Quadratus was the governor. Okay, in the lower section is Judea, or from a Roman perspective, it's also often called Palestine. The southern section is where Felix was governor. So you have basically two neighboring states. Quadratus is up here. Felix is down here, okay? All right, so this is important. So Nebodinus was sent bound to Rome by Quadratus from Syria at the same time with Ananias. So Nebodinus and Ananias, father and son, were sent to Rome in bonds that they might account, that they might give an account of their conduct to Claudius Caesar. And we'll talk about why they were sent. At the time when Ananias was sent, he was prefect of the temple. Okay? Essentially serving as high priest. Now, remember, the Romans had quite a bit to do with the, not only the political organization, but also the religious organization at the time. So, the reason for this is that Nebodinus, Ananias' father, and Ananias, along with other Jewish, Palestinian, or Judean, and Syrian, and Roman leaders, okay, so there's a whole bunch of people involved in this, they were accused of being a part of a series of disturbances between the Jews and the Samaritans of Palestine, or Judea, the lower southern section, okay? The Jews accused the Samaritans of murdering Jewish pilgrims on their way to Jerusalem as they were traveling through Samaritan territory, as well as bribing Roman officials to look the other way. So, from the Jewish perspective, they accused the Samaritans of killing their people as they're traveling to Jerusalem, and then also paying off the Romans, which meant that the Romans were then guilty of taking bribes. Okay, from the Samaritan perspective, they accused Jewish bands of sacking their villages. And you know what? There was probably a whole lot of truth on both sides of that. So the Samaritans had issues with the Jews, these roving bands of Jewish gangs going around and sacking their villages. And so in retaliation, the Samaritans were killing the Jewish pilgrims. And to keep it all covered up, I would bet both sides were paying the Romans, and the Romans were happy to take it. Okay, so this is the political situation that we find ourselves in. Many officials from Rome, Judea, and Syria were presented before Quadratus, who initially deferred judgment. Now remember, Quadratus, again, he's the governor of the northern area of Syria. He initially says, you know what, I'm not going to deal with this. So, in proper Roman, in proper Roman method, instead of really dealing with it, he basically takes all the prisoners that were captured of both Jewish and Samaritan ancestry and crucified them all. Like, done with this. Okay, here's all the witnesses. Gone. Okay? So then all that's left really are the officials from all these different, you know, from the Romans, the Samaritans, and the Jews. So he has them all crucified in Caesarea. Now, Quadratus eventually grants a second hearing to the Samaritans, which, again, I don't know that I'd want to be... Can we talk to you again? I don't know. Maybe that's what Quadratus was after, but... He grants a second hearing to the Samaritan case in Lydda, and of course the end result is that he essentially sides with the Samaritans, which I would imagine were probably paying higher bribes. I mean, let's just be honest. And it resulted in the execution of several Jewish officials. Okay, so these are all the events that are occurring here. Now, it was after these events that Nebodinus and Ananias, along with many other officials, were sent to appear before Claudius in Rome. So Quadratus deals with this issue, realizes that it's a little bit more widespread than they originally had assumed, and they get Nebodinus and Ananias. They realize that they're involved in some way, shape, or form, and then they send him off to Rome to speak to Claudius. Now, obviously, you consider how long it takes, and we'll actually talk about that when we start talking about Paul's trip to Rome. It takes quite a bit of time to get from Jerusalem to Rome. Whether you're going over land or over sea, it takes quite a bit of time. So keep that in mind. So Agrippa the Younger, which is Agrippa the Second, not Agrippa the First, and just for your information... This morning, my wife was probably wondering what I was doing. But I had to write myself a cheat sheet to keep track of all the Herods, all the kings. So, anyway, Agrippa the Second, now not King Agrippa the First, who was eaten by worms, not him, but his son, Agrippa the Second, is actually the guy who will eventually hear Paul's defense. Agrippa intercedes to Rome on behalf of Nebodinus and Ananias, and essentially they were dismissed and sent back to Jerusalem. So the time frame here, it's approximately a year, okay, in this time frame, okay, where Nebodinus and Ananias are sent and when they return. So there's about a year. All right. So Ananias, when he comes back, though, he was not reinstated to the official office of high priest when he returns to Jerusalem. Because when Felix, who was governor of Judea, when Ananias was gone, Felix had somebody else fill the role by the name of Jonathan. Jonathan... was slain in the temple itself. Okay, so Jonathan was the high priest that had been appointed by Felix while Ananias was gone. Okay, so Jonathan was slain, he was killed in the temple itself by the instigation of Felix, who had appointed him. He had sent assassins who had been hired for that very purpose, called the Sicarii. Okay? So, this is how Josephus describes this. He says, Felix bore an ill will to Jonathan, the high priest, because he frequently gave him admonitions about governing the Jewish affairs better than he did, lest complaints should be made against him, since he had procured of Caesar the appointment of Felix as procurator of Judea. Accordingly, Felix contrived by a method by which he might get rid of Jonathan, whose admonitions had become troublesome to him. Felix persuaded one of Jonathan's most faithful friends, of the name of Doris, to bring the robbers upon him and put him to death. So Felix appoints him. Jonathan's really good at what he does. He's not afraid to talk to Felix and speak out against Felix's ability to rule the Jews. Felix doesn't like it that Jonathan's got some good ideas and that he's probably gaining somewhat of a following. So Felix convinces one of Jonathan's closest friends to kill him and invites in the assassins, and they kill him in the temple. Okay, so all of this was done in Jerusalem. The robbers, they came into the city as if to worship God, and with daggers, which they had concealed under their garments, they put him to death. Now, after the death of Jonathan, the office of high priest remained vacant, officially vacant, until King Agrippa appointed Ismael, the son of Phabi, to the office sometime later. So, let's just rehash some of this for just a second. So, you have this dispute between the Jews and the Samaritans, and the Romans are involved. Quadratus calls him, kills a bunch of them, decides to hear from him again, figures out that, well, in his mind, that the Samaritans were probably right, and so the Jews needed to pay for this. So he then gets Ananias and Nebodinus, along with several others, and ships them off to Rome to talk to Claudius, the emperor. Okay? Now, while these guys, Nebodinus and Ananias specifically, while they're in Rome, Agrippa speaks on their behalf. And before Nebodinus and Ananias were there, Ananias was serving as high priest. Now, when Ananias comes back, though, he isn't reassigned as high priest. So, a couple of things that come to my mind is that maybe the deal Agrippa made was that don't kill them, but I won't put them back in officially in charge. It seems to make sense to me. So, it was during this interval, and then, of course, during this time frame while they're gone, Jonathan is assigned as high priest. Felix doesn't like him, has him killed. Ananias and Nebodinus return, but Ananias is never given the official high priest office again. It was a vacant until after, shortly after this, actually, after these events that are recorded here took place. So, this time period here, Ananias was then at Jerusalem, and as the office of high priest was officially vacant, and he was the last person still living that had served in that capacity, he was basically by common, by agreement, essentially amongst the Jewish people, well, he's the last guy that served, we don't really care what the Romans have to say, so we're going to put him in charge. We're going to let him officiate as the high priest, but with no official notice or confirmation. So he was discharging the duties by common consent, at least as far as to preside in the Sanhedrin. So remember, the Sanhedrin was a council, and as we read here in these verses, made up of Sadducees and Pharisees. Now, for the longest time, it had primarily been Sadducees, and then Pharisees over time had started to work their way in, if you will. So, as far as presiding over the council, Ananias was certainly taking on those duties. I got a question. Would Paul have been aware of this? I would say Absolutely. Paul was no dummy. I'm sure he understood what had been going on. I'm sure that if there had been that much of a dispute, that a bunch of people on both sides of the dispute had been crucified by Rome, and then the high priest in Jerusalem was sent to speak to the emperor, I'm sure word would have gotten back to Paul at one point or another, and or they may have had that discussion while they were in Jerusalem when they came back and talked to the elders. Of course, it was not recorded for us. Now, I believe that Paul knew all of these events. And I think part of that is illustrated by what happens at the council here and what Paul does in order to cease the discussion. Let me just put it that way. So, I think Paul was absolutely aware of this, and this is why he says in verse 5, and Paul said, I was not aware, brethren, that he was high priest. I think this is why he says it. I think this is the logical explanation for why he says it. But he also says in verse 3, God is going to strike you, you whitewashed wall. Do you sit to try me according to the law, and in violation of the law, order me to be struck? Now, I think these two verses together kind of give you the best answer for why Paul says what he does in verse 5. Because was Ananias acting in accordance with the Mosaic law that he was supposed to hold up? No. He was a vicious man. He was greedy. You go back and you look at the Old Testament prophet escapes me all of a sudden, where he accuses them of eating the lambs, eating the sheep, eating the flock instead of caring for the flock. This is Ananias. So Paul does not recognize the authority that has been given to Ananias essentially by the world. He doesn't recognize Ananias as being one who keeps the law, who is even serving justly and righteously as the office of high priest. He's not giving him that credit. Okay? So, this is interesting. So, I think these facts that we've talked about, Paul would have been well aware of, as I mentioned. And so, I think this also lends some credibility to the fact that Luke records history very, very accurately and very precisely with the special circumstances when they existed. Luke was well aware of what was going on, so was Paul, and so Luke is very careful to record these events so that we can see them today. So, when Luke here, in these verses, calls Ananias the high priest, he evidently intends not to affirm that he was actually such, that he was actually the high priest, but to use the word, as the Jews did, as applicable to one who had been in that office and who, on that occasion, when the office was vacant, performed its duties. Again, I don't think Luke is saying this guy is the recognized high priest by the law, but because that's how everybody else in Jerusalem was recognizing him, that's why Luke uses the phrase that he does. So, when Ananias commands that Paul be struck on the mount, well, before I get to that, is that clear as mud? Got a pretty good idea of the fact that this isn't just a linear, you know, real straightforward answer. There's a lot going on here. There's a lot of background that isn't recorded in Scripture, but it is recorded in Josephus' history specifically, as well as others. But a lot going on here that we're not necessarily aware of unless we dig into it. Mr. Dave?
One thing to keep in mind, too, is to remember the fact that Paul is Roman, and he's also a Pharisee. Before he becomes a Christian. So he is well aware of everything that is transpiring.
Yeah, absolutely. I think he would be foolish not to keep up on what's going on. Mr. Taylor.
I just kind of wonder maybe Occam's razor about simplification and mm-hmm. possibly visually you could tell the Pharisees from the Sadducees just mm-hmm. like Jesus at the well, and you know, what are you doing talking to a Samaritan? How did you know? Mm-hmm. There might be a difference in dress, and I kind of think that the high priest was supposed to wear special clothing too, and so he may not have been rent. Might have been looking like a regular Pharisee. That's just my input on it.
Yeah, that is very true. The high priest was required and did wear specific garb. And knowing what we know of Ananias, I would think that he would have been in full high priestly garb as much as he could get away with. That would be my guess. Mr. Toole.
A couple thoughts, might save one for later, but I get the picture from the Gospels that the people themselves, kind of going back to your comment earlier, in violation of the law, order me to be struck, like they were kind of botching this whole high priesthood thing anyway.
Yeah.
Because Luke records in chapter 3, now let me get through these names, in the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, when Pontius Pilate was governor of Judea, Herod was tetrarch of Galilee, his brother Philip was tetrarch of the region of Iturea and Trachonitis, and Lysanias was tetrarch of Abilene, in the high priesthood of Annas and Caiaphas. The word came to John. Well, how many high priests are there supposed to be?
Well, just one.
There's supposed to be one, but there's two.
Right.
And now that's a byproduct of, and you see this, and you can see why the feet in the statue in Daniel are partly mixed with clay and with iron, because there's two high priests, and the Romans had something to do with that. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, these guys are already having a hard time just having one.
Right.
And so, and then sometimes the one that you get kind of corrupt anyway, as you pointed out. So,
and honestly, it reminds me, this whole situation that we're talking about reminds me of the iterations of the Catholic Church with the Pope. There's been much political intrigue involved in that as well. It's a whole other discussion. But it's not surprising considering how the Catholic Church was organized. But that's, again, another discussion that I don't want to get into. All right. So, verse 2, Ananias commands that Paul be struck on the mouth. Now, why would you do that? There's a couple of reasons for it. First of all, in most of the time when somebody was addressing the Sanhedrin, they were told when to speak. The Sanhedrin would take their seats, you know, they would, you know, with the pomp and the circumstance, they would, you know, get comfortable, and then they would say, here is XYZ person, they're accused of ABC, speak. Well, from what we can see here recorded, Paul doesn't wait for that. He waits for them to seat, and then he begins speaking. So that's one of the possible reasons why Ananias had him struck in the mouth. Now, that's not according to the law. That's not what you're supposed to do. You're not supposed to strike somebody in the mouth for that. I think more likely it's because Ananias doesn't like Paul. Doesn't like Paul saying, hey, I've lived my life with a clear conscience before God, and guess what? Paul could say it, and he believed it, and he knew it was true. Ananias, in his conscience, he knew he couldn't say that. But Ananias was just mad at him. He wanted to stop him from speaking and to express their indignation at what he had just said regarding his conscience. The anger of Ananias was aroused because Paul affirmed that all he had done and had been doing was with a good conscience. They regarded him as guilty. I think that the Sanhedrin, they weren't, this was like a kangaroo court. They had already made up their minds. They knew Paul was guilty. They were just waiting for somebody to bring him in. Remember, the Jews from Asia are the ones who started this. Again, probably a certain amount of collusion between the Jewish officials in Asia and probably the Sanhedrin, or at least a few of them. They had already decided that he was guilty, and they regarded him as an apostate. Remember, this is the guy who had once been a willing weapon in their arsenal and was now being wielded against them. They considered him apostate, and they couldn't bear that he, with such coolness and firmness, declared that all his conduct had been under the direction of a good conscience and by God. And they didn't want to hear it. So, the injustice of the command of Ananias is apparent to all. Verse 3, Paul's response, I want to read this again. He says, God is going to strike you, you whitewashed wall. Do you sit to try me according to the law and in violation of the law, order me to be struck? If you call somebody a whitewashed wall, somebody else mentioned that once. Who was that mentioned that? Oh, yeah, he was a funny-looking guy from Nazareth. Didn't look like a king, but boy, he sure spoke like one. To call somebody a whitewashed wall was not a compliment. It was basically to call him a hypocrite. Man, you have cleaned the outside of that cup, but the inside is dirty. You've whitewashed the tombs, but the inside is full of dead men's bones. So when Paul says you're whitewashed, doesn't sit very well with Ananias, of course. But it's not simply in an outburst of anger or indignation, but it's actually predictive of the judgment to be meted out against Ananias. So, verse 3, God is going to strike you, you whitewashed wall. God is going to strike you, you whitewashed wall. Jerusalem, under the control of the Romans at this time, was not a very peaceful place. Remember why the commander had originally come and gotten Paul? Because he thought that he might have been the ringleader of the assassins that tried to start an insurrection. Well, guess what? About a year later, about a year after this, details are a little fuzzy, but about a year after this, Ananias and his brother Hezekiah, neither of which were good people, of course, they were killed a few years later. Again, it's anywhere between a year and 2 years, and so I put a few, should say couple, but anyway, during an uprising in the city. Okay, so there's an uprising in the city, essentially led by the Jewish people who had had enough of Ananias and Hezekiah, and they chased them down into the sewers, and Ananias and Hezekiah try to hide out, to just kind of wait for it to fall, to pass over, and then have maybe the Romans get some control. Well, it doesn't work out very well for them. They catch him, they drag him out, and then the Sicarii, the assassins or the robbers, captured them, and they killed him and his brother Hezekiah. So not long after Paul says this, Ananias and Hezekiah are killed, I think probably by some of the same people that they had hired to kill other people, but that's a whole other set of discussion. So, I don't know if Paul was necessarily prophesying, but he was sure predicting. So not long after this, Ananias is gone. And if nothing else, Paul knew that at one point or another, this guy's hypocrisy was not going to escape God's judgment. Okay? So, this smacking somebody in the mouth to get them to stop, sound familiar? Let's go over to John, chapter 18. This is, of course, Jesus before the priests, verse 19. We'll start there. It says, the high priest then questioned Jesus about his disciples and about his teaching. Jesus answered him, I have spoken openly to the world. I always taught in the synagogues and in the temple where all the Jews came together, and I spoke nothing in secret. Why do you question me? Question those who have heard what I spoke to them. They know what I said. When he had said this, one of the officers standing nearby struck Jesus, saying, is that the way you answer the high priest? Jesus answered, if I have spoken wrongly, testify of the wrong. But if rightly, why do you strike me? Sound familiar? Maybe Jesus spoke a few more words there, but same situation. These guys are speaking the truth, and they get smacked in the mouth. So Paul's description of him being a whitewashed wall was an implication of Ananias' hypocrisy as illustrated by his violation of the law. Mosaic law prescribed that no injustice be done to the accused while under trial and that they be allowed to defend themselves against their accusers. Lots of Old Testament verses we can go to there. But the basic point of this is that the law that Moses had been given by God and that Moses then gave to the people said, treat somebody who is accused fairly. Don't smack them around. Don't beat them up to try to get a confession out of them. You know, don't threaten to crucify their family so that you can get what you want out of them. Don't do that. Treat them fairly. Leviticus 19, Exodus 23, and Deuteronomy chapter 19. If you want those verses, I can give them to you, but that's essentially where it comes from. There is no one particular verse that says you shalt not smack the person on the mouth. There is no verse that says that. But the general intent of the law is very clearly explained there. So the bystanders here, verse 4, but the bystander said, do you revile God's high priest? Now, where was Paul? He wasn't in a Roman court. He was standing before the Sanhedrin, which is comprised of Sadducees and Pharisees. So the bystanders, who were the others in the council, they attempt to accuse Paul of disrespecting the office of the high priest. And all of this, defending Ananias, despite knowing that Ananias was a vicious and greedy person. The council supported him. At least most of the council did. And you know, many had turned a blind eye to Ananias' many sins and violations of the law, and Paul brought it out. And this, I mean, I think it's tough to really, you put yourself in that situation, maybe as, you know, a fly on the wall, it'd be one of those, ooh, did he just say that to the high priest? I mean, it was, in my opinion, it was a bigger deal than simply a verse here. But, of course, Paul refuses, as discussed earlier, to acknowledge Ananias as high priest. So at this point, the conversation makes a little bit of a shift. So all of this background that we've talked about, all of this discussion around who Ananias was and the history behind him and how he got into his position and where he was currently, I think what Mr. Toole had said is very well illustrated in this next segment. They had not been doing this whole high priest thing right for a long time. It was a mess. It was more embroiled in political intrigue than it was in the righteousness of the law. And so Paul, I think he recognizes this almost immediately, which is, in my opinion, again, probably why he started out the way that he did with, like, you know what, we can go through all the niceties of this council, but it's not going to end up, we're not going to make any progress here. Paul probably would have recognized most of the people in the council anyway, or at least a good number of them, because remember, he was very close to that council before. Okay? So he recognizes what's going on here. Verse 6, before I move on to verse 6, any comments or questions? Mr. Toole.
Well, just one extra thought because of what you just said. Like, Paul understands, like, what's happening in front of him, mm-hmm. and that's how you're getting to your next point here, how he's going to notice what's comprising the group and kind of get to maybe what's underneath the layers. Mm-hmm. And so because that's the context, I've also often wondered. It is true, Paul's been gone for a long time, mm-hmm. and this office of high priesthood's kind of been a little... It's been rotating, and it's very possible he comes back to Jerusalem and just doesn't even know the name of the high priest anymore. He's been gone for so long, and I think that is true. But I've also wondered, like, he understands what's going on beneath the whitewashed tomb. He knows what's going on beneath the surface. And so because the context is he's going to go in and divide these groups by saying just one statement, I believe he's already began. Because who is the merciful and faithful high priest?
Right.
Like, the law is gone. Yeah. And maybe there's someone in the Sanhedrin or a witness there that day that heard that and got them thinking. But I've also kind of wondered if maybe Paul says that, not because he doesn't recognize the guy or know his name, or because he knows who the high priest is. Mm-hmm. And it ain't a man.
Right.
It's Jesus Christ.
Yeah. Good point. Yep. So I don't... Well, we'll see how far we can get, I guess. All right, so verse 6, conversation or the situation takes a little bit of a different turn. He says, but perceiving that one group were Sadducees and the other Pharisees. Now, I'm not going to go into the history of the Sadducees and the Pharisees, but they didn't really like each other. If you want a good explanation, it's Republicans and Democrats. Republicans and Democrats. And the way that they fight, okay? And so Paul began crying out in the council, Trump for president, brethren, I am a Pharisee, a son of Pharisees, and I am on trial for the hope and resurrection of the dead. Paul recognizes the situation, and he cries out to one side, not necessarily because he supports them, but because he knows the response it's going to elicit. We see the response here in verse 7. As he said this, there occurred a dissension between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. Paul understood exactly what was going on here. He knew the Sanhedrin wasn't a righteous group. He knew that they were more interested in their political positions than they were in the truth. So he stokes the fire and pours on some gasoline and watches it burn. Verse 8, for the Sadducees say there is no resurrection, nor an angel, nor a spirit, but the Pharisees acknowledge them all. There's the main point of their disagreement, okay, among other things, but that's the primary point. Verse 9, and there occurred a great uproar, and some of the scribes of the Pharisaic party stood up and began to argue heatedly, saying, we find nothing wrong with this man. Suppose a spirit or an angel has spoken to him. And as a great dissension was developing, the commander was afraid Paul would be torn to pieces by them and ordered the troops to go down and take him away from them by force and bring him into the barracks. So this mob mentality that had overtaken the people and had caused Paul to get arrested in the first place was repeated in the Sanhedrin. People who honestly were supposed to be keeping the law and keeping order amongst the Jewish people. And by that one statement, Paul lit them up. Okay? Any comments on that section, and then we'll close? No? Okay. So, next week... Yeah, I think we'll just leave it there. So, next week, we'll pick it up here in verse 11, and we'll talk a little bit more about Paul's life. Oh, and then I'm gone a week after this, so I'm gone the 10th, or whatever day that is. So... I think Mr. Simpson will be bringing you some more info. So, thank you for your kind attention. You're dismissed.